Now we're into Typhoon Meggy.
Is it?
Yes, which one at least?
The big one, this one.
Okay. So this is an overview slide for my work in my personal work in ITOP. So we deployed four floats in Phanape, nicely on a line, each of them with an EM apex. We deployed three floats successfully. Well, we tried in Meggy, which were there. It was a little harder to hit Meggy. Those two boxes are on roughly the same scale, so you can see how much smaller a storm Meggy was than Phanape, which made it a lot harder to hit. Not quite. We deployed one float in Malacca that didn't work, and we did one Revel test float, which was a marginal success, and we got the float back. That's good. All of the eight floats that that we deployed successfully gave us excellent data. They've all got temperature, salinity, and pressure. They've all got ambient sound, which I'll talk a bit about in a bit. One of these has vector velocity, which isn't very good. And we have on the Meggy floats, we have oxygen gas tension. They're all deployed with EM apex, so we have vertical contact for all of them. I expect to submit this data to ITOP.org. We have preliminary data now. We expect to have full quality control in September or so, and I'm the contact. Another issue that I think is going to come up a lot here is this issue of products. This is data. Does anybody really want, 20 gigabytes of raw sound data? I don't think so. What people really want are some products from that, and we have to think about what those are going to be and how we're going to deal with them, not just in my case. So, this is the instrument. You've seen bits of this before. This is my Lagrangian float. The basic thing which makes it different from other instruments is that it's designed to follow three-dimensional motion of water parcels within the boundary layer. So this is a record from the float closest to the Meggy eye, and the float goes up and down and up and down at sort of 10 centimeters a second with a turnover time of somewhat less than an hour. And that's how fast the water is going up and down, because that's what it's designed to do. And so we get an estimate of the vertical velocity of the water in the boundary layer. From that, we can measure turbulence, and as you'll see in a minute, we can also measure surface waves. So it looks like this. It's about this big. We air deploy it, about those things. And it works by being neutrally buoyant and having a high drag, which I'm not going to talk about much now. The key measurements that we have are accurate vertical velocity from pressure, changes in pressure from which you can get vertical kinetic energy, which I'm going to talk quite a bit about, and also some estimates of dissipation rates and covariance fluxes, which I'm not going to talk about today. And I said we can do surface wave spectra, and we have broadband sound from 30 hertz to 50 kilohertz, and I'll talk about that in a moment here. So, one of the things which I think is going to be very interesting is we think we can measure surface wave, scalar surface wave spectra from the floats. The way that works is, here's the float, we have a pressure sensor at the middle of the float, we also have a pressure sensor at the top, on some of them, but not in this experiment, we have one on the bottom too. Now it's a kinematic property of surface waves that they have no pressure signal along Lagrangian trajectories, so if it's a Lagrangian float, you should see no pressure fluctuations through the surface waves at the center pressure sensor, and in fact you don't, with some caveats which I'm not going to get into. But that top pressure sensor isn't at a Lagrangian point, it's 50 centimeters above a Lagrangian point, so there is a surface pressure signal, and the difference between those is a filter for surface waves. And here's an example of a surface wave acceleration spectrum. Acceleration, since normal surface wave spectra are sort of minus 4-ish, an acceleration spectrum should be roughly white. That makes it easier to plot. And so this is a spectrogram of time going this way, frequency going that way. That's a 10-second wave. This is the spectrum of pressure compensated in each spectrum for the exponential decay of surface waves. And what you can see is this is the surface waves here, and this is turbulence and noise. And there's a break at roughly 10 second period, which is about right. There's a clear spectral gap between that and that. That spectrum's roughly white, which is what it should be. If the displacement spectrum for minus 4, that makes you confident. These big white holes here are where the float was too deep, and we're just looking at noise extrapolated to surface, so there's no data there. The peak period is what you get from running along there, and there it's 10 seconds, there it's 13 seconds. Notice that'll show up in a moment. And it's back to 8 seconds. Those are all pretty reasonable numbers. And the significant wave height you get from integrating from there to the end of the data is about 5 to 10 meters, depending on where you are in the record. And that's pretty reasonable. Like, sure, I could check it against other things, and it more or less agrees with what Tom Sanford's EMAPEX say. So there, you know, they might be a measurement of surface wave spectrum, and I hope to get more on that from comparing with other people's data. So the other unique thing we have is ambient sound. We go all the way from 30 hertz to 50 kilohertz, and we get a spectrum sometimes every 30 seconds, sometimes more often, detailed, not going to talk about. Traditionally, it's been shown that for moderate wind speeds, sort of 7 to 10 kilohertz is very well, exceptionally well correlated with surface wind speed. But it's known that this fails at higher wind speeds. That's why the anemometers that, were used on the early Miele buoys didn't give you good wind speed, because when you go to high wind speeds, it fails, as I'm about to show you. We now have sound levels from 4 different floats and 2 different storms, and expect to have 4 more out of FNAPI, though that's not been processed yet. And they all show the pattern that's shown here. Sound level on this axis, wind speed on that axis, the different colors are different acoustic frequencies. And so if you look, for instance, at the traditional sort of 9 kilohertz, in the sort of 10 to 20 meter a second range, it increases, but then it decreases. And that increase and decrease is part of a larger pattern of the low frequencies increasing more or less monotonically with wind speed, particularly around 100 hertz, and the high frequencies decreasing. So what's going on is that the way the noise is coming from wave breaking and from bubbles generated from wave breaking oscillating. And so you have more breaking waves, you get more sound. So that's what's happening here. But the bubbles also absorb sound. So if the sound is being created at the surface and you're subsurface, the sound being generated at the surface is absorbed by the bubbles. And that accounts for the decrease. And of course, there's a transition. So some frequencies first increase and then decrease. And so the hope is to invert some of this to get both bubble concentrations and wave breaking rates for MEGI and FNAPI. And I haven't done that yet. You may notice that there's different symbols here for different floats in different places. And the fact that they all sort of follow the same pattern makes you think there might be a common pattern. And maybe someday this would become a good way to measure tropical cyclone wind speeds from the low frequency sound. But we're not quite there yet. But that's where we're going. So now I'm going to talk about my pet rock. And my pet rock, which I've been kicking down the path, I think the metaphor is getting stretched. Is what drives turbulence in the ocean boundary layer? Is it the wind stress or is it the waves? For all the existing models that we have, probably the exception of someone who's going to ask me a question, basically say that the currents in the ocean and the turbulence in the upper ocean are set up by the wind stress. And yet we have very strong theoretical reasons to believe that wave breaking and Langmuir circulations will play a big role in that physics. And the question is, how can you detangle that? Well, I've been beating that horse for a long time with data from all sorts of places in the world. Here's an example of the not too successful attempts. This is RMS vertical velocity from floats, how fast they're going round and round the boundary layer versus wind speed from lots of data in lots of places. And there's a very good correlation, which basically says that the RMS vertical velocity is about the friction velocity, the wind stress. This just says, even if it was wind or if it was waves, they're well correlated, so correlation doesn't help you very much. An excellent example of correlation not necessarily implying causality. The solution to this problem is not to go to these generic places, but go to places where the wind and the waves are not well correlated, and tropical cyclones, as you'll see, are a good place to go for that. So, a little off the topic, but it leads into it. We just finished an experiment, or in the process of finishing an experiment, comparing a lake which has wind, but hardly any waves, because there's no fish, to the open ocean. The lake is Lake Washington near Seattle, and the open ocean is Ocean Station Papa, as generic a spot in the ocean as you can get. And this is vertical kinetic energy, vertical velocity versus wind stress, and that's Papa, and that's the lake. So lo and behold, when you have bigger waves, as opposed to bigger waves, you get bigger energy in the boundary layer, smaller waves, smaller energy in the boundary layer. Hey, that's cool, and the magnitudes are consistent with Langmuir physics, so that's a different story. So, can we see anything like this in tropical cyclones? I have two cases that make suggestion that you could. One's in Hurricane Gustav. So here's Hurricane Gustav, there's Louisiana, storms propagating that way. We have three floats, one that goes to the peak winds, one goes to the eye, one goes to the edge. They're color-coded, so let's look at the red one. It goes to the peak winds on the right-hand side of the storm. A little thin line is wind stress, or U star keeps square, but that doesn't matter. Goes up, comes down. The thick line is the vertical kinetic energy for floats. It goes up and it comes down, and they're about the same level, so that's consistent with everything else we've seen, no big surprise. Look at the edge, yeah, that's sort of the same level, that's consistent with what we've seen in the past. But look at the eye. Wind stress, thin line, goes up, goes down in the eye, comes back up in the backside, and goes back down again. But the vertical kinetic energy goes up, down, and doesn't come back again. So there's a big deficit of turbulence back there. Now, I don't know why that is, but if there was a place you were to pick in the storm where the wind and the waves wouldn't be very well aligned, it's somewhere in this back quadrant. So that's probably what's going on. In fact, if the wind is going opposite the waves, there's anti-Langmuir cell physics, and it suppresses the turbulence. So there's a hint that that's what's going on. And we ought to, in Phanapi, we have one there, one there, one there, and one there. Anyway, so we ought to be able to see this in Phanapi. But I haven't done that yet. The other example is from Typhoon Megi. Here's a wind field from Megi. There's the track. There's a storm. There's a storm. There's a float, and some floats here I'm not going to look at. I'm going to look at this float here that was in pretty strong winds, marginal tropical cyclone winds in Megi. Same plot as before, but with some other stuff. The thin line is the wind stress. In this case, I don't think we're using Donald. I don't know what we're using. Goes up, comes down, because it went through the wind. But the vertical kinetic energy goes way up, way too high, and comes down, and it peaks before the wind peaks. So something funny is going on there. What could that funny thing be? Well, if you look at the red line, that's my estimate of surface wave height. And the surface waves also peak before the wind peaks. And if you look at the dashed line, that's sound level at 100 hertz. And that also peaks. So that's some sort of wave-breaking thing, probably before. So the suggestion is that because this storm is so small, there's something really funky going on with the waves. In other words, maybe the storm here has got a big bolus of high surface waves out in front of it that you wouldn't see in a larger storm. We'll find out if that's true, I hope. And there's a lot of interesting hints here, and I hope to follow up on those. So that's what I want to do. I want to look at this sort of stuff. That will be very much with LAS modeling of this. Be working on gas exchange. Craig McNeil will talk about that, and waves and wave breaking and bubbles. I need winds and fluxes and wave simulations, and all lots of other things that everybody else needs. Thanks.
How do you separate the wave breaking, which I presumably is at scales of turbulence, from, I mean, early on you said you could separate those two things. In the very first part of your talk?
In the very first part
of your talk, you had a neat way of saying everything to the left of this frequency was turbulence.
Because waves, no, I didn't say anything about breaking in that figure. All I said was that surface waves have frequencies that are sort of,
breaks, it seems like.
Okay. There's something very subtle there. When waves break, they're not linear. And therefore, the rule about not seeing any any wave signature from the center pressure shouldn't apply. In fact, it doesn't. The waves that break have some special acute pressure signals, but that's.
Okay,
that's
all. I was just curious.
Okay. I would love to work more on that. That's really a cool thing.
Go ahead, Pete.
Eric, about the wave breaking, you know, you've got two types of wave breaking in tropical cyclones. You've got the local sea that breaks along the crest of the swells, and the swells can be moving off at 90 or 120 degrees to the wind, but the local sea will still be breaking in the direction of the wind. How do you swell that up?
Well, since we have very little data, anything will help, right?
One other quick question. How do you sort out the difference between between ambient sound noise due to precipitation and ambient sound noise due to wave breaking?
Well, there's a subtler question, and how do you distinguish at 40 meters a second between spray hitting the water and rain hitting the water? If there's more spray than there is rain, so I don't know the answer to that. At modest winds, there's a very distinct signature of rain. Very, very, it's sort of 10, 15 meters a second, and very modest will come out of that. And I don't know how we think about these cases. And what you do is you look at the data, and you look where it's raining from other data, and you try to figure it out.
But same thing that you do for the SFMR, where you have unpeaked frequencies and observations, and you do an old determinant least squares, that's the two parameters you're interested in.
I sure hope so. I don't know yet.
Tom would like to vote.
Yes, sir.
There's some hope that we might be able to say something about breaking in the event, but if you look at the highly sampled data, it sometimes becomes very non-sinusoidal.
Good.
Thanks, sir. Next, Dan.